This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, it's New Books in Urban Studies. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm your host, Yadong Li, a PhD student in anthropology at Tulane University. Urban decay, deindustrialization, and gentrification are phenomena more and more witnessed across the globe. The book we will discuss in today's podcast invites us to think critically about locality and urban neighborhood revival. Based on two cases in Montreal, Canada, this book reveals how local heritage can be an agent of gentrification rather than resources, investigates how places acquire race and class identities, and also this book questions what is preserved and for whom. So I'm very excited to talk with the author of the book, Professor Stephen Hai. Welcome to New Books in Urban Studies, Professor Hai.
Well, thank you so much, Yadong, for inviting me.
I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk about this fantastic book. So this new book, Deindustrializing Montreal, Entangled Histories of Race, Residence, and Class, is published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2022. Professor Stephen Hai is professor of history at Concordia University and the Center for Oral History and Digital Storytelling. Professor Hai is an interdisciplinary oral and public historian with academic interest in working class studies, forced migration, and community-engaged research. So before we formally started this interview, Professor Hai, your research is definitely very influential in the fields of deindustrialization and working class history and also oral history. But as our audiences of New Books Network are from very different backgrounds and from very various disciplines, I think it would be helpful to let our audience to know more about you before our interview. So could you please introduce yourself to our audience a little bit, and especially what made you be interested in oral history and deindustrialization?
Well, it's a great question. I'm originally from Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is right on the north shore of Lake Superior, so not too far from Duluth, Minnesota. And it's a resource town, working class town. My father was a railway switchman, so he had the night shift until I was 16. And so I grew up, in this working class context that was deindustrializing. My father was a bridge to retirement at age 51. So his working life ended quite abruptly. And oral history sort of came to me by chance. I was an undergraduate student at the University of Ottawa. I left to go to a university and I came back home and I got a job in my hometown museum as an oral historian for a minimum wage. Like, it was really terrible money, but they gave me an old cassette recorder and a bunch of blank cassettes, and they said, go interview old people. And so I spent the whole summer interviewing people, and I fell in love with the methodology. Like, that I it sort of taught me a lesson that history is not just up there, out there somewhere. It's actually in here. It inhabits our families and our communities, and it's personal, right? And so this is how I approach the writing of history.
Fascinating. I can see definitely your personal connection with your academic interests. And basically, I think you did really well to present your reader why history is basically from your heart, from your mind, rather than from, something transcendent or something from higher level. So definitely fascinating. So as I mentioned, this is a book with multiple topics and purposes. I can see you talk about identity formation, class struggle, urban issues like deindustrialization and gentrification. And also, you also have many chapters reflecting on the revival program in the working class neighborhoods. So for a book with such extensive information as the author, what do you think this book is about?
That's a hard question. It's like saying, summarize your whole study in like 20 seconds. But it's a book about people and place, and it's about two places, Pointe Saint-Charles and Little Burgundy, which are two working class neighbors that face each other across the Lachine Canal in sort of the most industrialized part of Canada. It industrialized early. And these neighborhoods formed around the factories. And one neighborhood, Pointe Saint-Charles, is very white. One neighborhood is really the first multiracial neighborhood in Montreal. And so to me, there's proximity there, but there's also divergence. And so it's an opportunity to think about class and race together. I think sometimes in the academy, it's like we're forced to choose, right? We're going to study class or we're going to study race. And I think it's so important to think about these together. And so racial capitalism is certainly one way that I bridge the two, thinking about how urban space is constructed through capitalism and through racial structures. And so it's a deep sort of analysis of waves of change, right? And how these waves are connected and what this means for people.
Oh, I love your description. It's basically, I think in anthropology, we always use the word entanglement. And I think this book definitely perfectly shows how these different issues entangle with each other to present this deindustrializing Montreal. So basically, oral history has a characteristic of being public. So I can see definitely this book is written not only for scholars, but also for broader public. So in your opinion, who are the expected audience of the book?
I think everyone who writes a book, every academic who writes a book, hopes that it reaches beyond the academy, right? That that we aspire to have a, to make a difference in the world that we live in. And we certainly need to make a difference in the world of today. And oral history is very much that way. The ethos of oral history as a field is that we believe that we should be working with the communities that we study, not just treating them as objects of study. I know anthropology, it's also in this mode now too. And so the project very much sort of emerged, in conversation with community organizations, with my students who were coming out of these neighborhoods. My university, Concordia University, is only about 200 meters from Little Burgundy, one of those two neighborhoods. And so there's a proximity there, but it's also a distance, right? It's a little bit up the hill, although not way up the hill. And so there's that distance we still had to bridge, right? And so absolutely, the book was intended for a wider audience. And it's written for both an academic and a wider audience. And I think I know you probably want to ask about the photographs, but it's heavily illustrated. I think for me, these illustrations are important to bridge people not from Montreal into the neighborhoods, but it's also a way to make the book more accessible to wider audiences. This book has really resonated in these two neighborhoods, you know, in part because, you know, they see themselves, they hear themselves, and it helps, you know, make sense for what, you know, these waves of transformation.
Definitely, definitely. I really want to have more information of this fascinating pictures and illustrations, because basically I think it strengthens the sense of interaction between the book itself, between your text and also your readers, your audiences. Fascinating. We will talk about it later. So the next question will be, what prompted you to do this specific project? Like, what brought you to these two specific neighborhoods in Montreal? Why these two neighborhoods? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've been studying deindustrialization since the mid-1990s. I'm very interested in sort of structural violence and how people understand and respond to catastrophic change. And my first book coming out of my PhD was focused on the Rust Belt, the making of the Rust Belt in the 1970s and 80s in the Midwest United States. And I was looking at how unions and governments and ordinary people sort of responded to that. Later, I wrote books on sort of thinking about deindustrialization or, dramatic economic change sort of on the economic periphery. So like in resource areas, forestry, mining, and so on, which is, tends to be understood a little bit differently. This book is focused on a metropolitan city, and what's interesting is we don't necessarily think of deindustrialization in the context of big cities like New York or Chicago or Montreal. Perhaps Detroit is the exception, right? Like Detroit is the poster child of the Rust Belt, but generally deindustrialized cities are often mid-size or smaller, the Youngstown, Ohio's of the world. And so so to me, it was a natural progression, combined with the fact that I moved to Montreal, like most academics, it's a lottery in terms of where you land. And so I landed in Montreal, and I moved to Point St. Charles. So this is also my way of researching my way into my new home, my adopted home, to make sense of how I fit into these processes, right? I'm not removed from these processes. I'm contributing to gentrification, right? And I talk a bit about that in the book, right? And so I think it's important for scholars to position themselves politically in the work and to reflect on that, within the work that we do.
Yeah, I think it's really about how to build this connection between your academic interests and your everyday life. So after this why question, we will talk about how question, which I'm very interested in. So I'm very interested in how you do this project, because it's such a long-term project with a great number of participants and researchers involved. So much of this book is drawn from the oral history interviews of 150 residents recorded over a 35 years period. So how do you, how your research focus and purposes changed over the course of this study? I think it must be some changes. And what triggered these changes?
Yeah. Well, my part was only 15 years. Like, there were archived interviews that were 35 years.
Okay.
I didn't start the project 35 years ago, but 15 is still substantial. And some projects are sort of linear, right? Like you jump right in and you move forward and it's done within 4 or 5 years. This one, was sort of a winding road, right? And I didn't set out to write a book. So this book is a culmination of many projects, right? Both research projects in various ways, like looking at, Black youth. There was a project called Map Collab where we were thinking about how young people sort of, think about their neighborhood. Another project was on labor mobility and sort of the post-industrial part. Other project was focused on Point St. Charles. I had many different research projects coming at it with, in different ways, right? And so it, in a way, it's sort of layered or sedimentation, or my knowledge was sort of certainly sedimented. And then also the teaching side. So I have, graduate students doing work, but also I started to embed my courses into these two neighborhoods. So, for example, there's the Negro Community Center, which is sort of the cultural hub of the Little Burgundy community for the Anglophone Black community. And it started in the 1920s, and it went until about 1989, and then it was abandoned, and then the boxes were like salvaged, like 150 boxes, and then they finally were made available. And so, I embed my students in the archive. So the whole term, they're going through these boxes, and so they're learning from the ground up, right? And so they develop projects, and and so I do a lot of that kind of work where students are actually, working with some of the archives that I've, oral history archives that I've, developed, through these research projects, but they're also then contributing and writing their own work and publishing their own work. And so it's like it's like the Mississippi, right? Like it's slow, it's a slow kind of research. And I think, a lot is gained from taking your time.
Wow, it's fascinating. It's such fascinating to see how you actually combine this different project, but you actually turn them into a system. This book is really a great work. And so basically, this book provides us, I think, in a systematic way with a cross-neighborhood comparative history, focusing on two neighborhoods we have mentioned before, Pont St. Charles and Little Burgundy. So I have two interconnected questions. So first, could you please introduce these two neighborhoods to our audience? And second, why do you choose this specific two neighborhoods to explore? I think you have already answered this question, but maybe you have more specific one, like this cultural heritage or its importance to Montreal. I don't know, but yeah, very looking forward to hearing more about it.
Yeah, I'm interested in sort of neighborhoods not as like static containers of history, but how neighborhood itself is a process and is a product of history. And so the emergence of, Little Burgundy as a neighborhood is actually quite recent. Like you had residential areas, and you had on one side you had this place called Saint-Henri, which is very Francophone white. On the other side, you had like the Irish, right? Also white, with very strong neighborhood identities. And in between, you had sort of like this fluid space that, with lots of names, right? They called all kinds of things, parish names and all this. And it's only with urban renewal in the 1960s, right, when much of the neighborhood is actually demolished and rebuilt as public housing, but not the high rise stuff. It's actually very much like suburban low rise. That this name sort of stuck. It was actually the name for the urban renewal project that then becomes the name of the neighborhood. And so I talk about like why this neighborhood's targeted, and I talk about how like the emergence of a Black community is very much tied, like many, many cities in the United States, tied to the railway. That this was the one of the few occupations that would employ Black men. So by the 1940s, 90% of Black men in Montreal are actually working for the railway. And this neighborhood is very close to the two main railway stations. So there's a logic, right, to why community institutions would emerge there, why you would have like, very much a multiracial neighborhood. Like it's only about 15% Black at its peak before urban renewal. So that's a Little Burgundy, right? So multiracial, lots of stuff happening. On the south side of the Lachine Canal. So the Lachine Canal is like, it's like the highway to the heart of the continent. So all the ships going to Chicago and Detroit and Buffalo or my hometown of Thunder Bay, Duluth, had to go up the Lachine Canal, right? It's the way in. And it was replaced in 1959 by a bigger canal, right, on the other side of the river. And so it became redundant and abandoned for a period, which is part of the story, that I'm telling here, because what happens to the canal matters for the neighborhoods adjoining. But on the south side is Point St. Charles. And Point St. Charles is like Irish, right? Working class, very proud, right? Connections to Boston. And on one side of the tracks, there's tracks that split the neighborhood in half. The other half it's French Catholic, right? And so you got all kinds of stuff going on there, right? And there's factories, like all on the canal, it's like wall-to-wall factories. There's factories sort of, adjoining the neighborhood. And so these are places, like both neighborhoods are places where people walk to work. They shop in these neighborhoods, they live in these neighborhoods. And so over time, over decades, that creates a very strong sense of place, right? That persists beyond the closures of the 1970s and 80s, right? And so these two neighborhoods, like, they're fascinating, right? That and they really are windows into these processes that we see in every city, right? I'm sure any viewer of this show can relate to this because this is happening everywhere.
Exactly. I live in New Orleans and I can fully understand what you mean by seeing these fascinating urban neighborhoods and their sense of place is fascinating. And basically, I think you have already tell us about how diverse people in this two neighborhood. And I think doing a research in this kind of neighborhood with high cultural and ethnic and class diversity, it must be a collaborative work, and this book is definitely an example of a collaborative work, collaborative oral history. And I think there are multiple participants of for doing this research. So could you please tell us how people make this collaborative work happen, and who has participated in the project and had and been benefiting from it, and in what ways?
These are great, like, questions of power, right? Like,
Yeah.
it's hugely important. And so I all the projects I talk about, both pedagogical and research, are all done in collaboration with community partners, right? So institutional partners in the neighborhood. So those students who are going through those archives, we're doing it, in partnership with the Black Church, so the Union United Church, or with the NCC Negro Community Center Board. And at the end of the term, they presented their research back to the community, right? And it was also a space for elders in the community to share their stories to the younger generation. And so to me, these projects open up spaces for conversation and engagement, also, but also critical reflection, right? Like, neighborhoods are not unitary. There's contestation, there's division. There's change, and who you partner with matters, right? Like, because it's like, we can talk about community and what that means, but I'm very committed to that kind of work, and I think oral history is a natural companion to that approach, right? Because in oral history, you are learning with, right? It's dialogical. You're going back and forth, and it's, a good interview is like two people working really hard to understand one person's life story. And I think a good project is sort of dialogical too, right? And so this project also had other outcomes. Like, the book wasn't the only outcome. Like, there's audio walks that people can do, and we link that in with the local, like, the neighborhood libraries, right? So it's not intended, it's not starting at the subway, right? For people coming into the neighborhood, it's sort of anchored in the neighborhood, so that people, from these two neighborhoods get to actually learn about their own histories.
Fascinating, fascinating. Do you have a website, or do you have a something like some viral material introducing this project? You can send a link to me, and I will put the link just in our introduction of our interview and make more people to know about it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, like, storytelling.concordia.ca, it's our oral history center's website, and there's a part for, like, audio walks, right? I'm big on audio walks because, like, audio walks are, you hear, and they're memory based, right? So you're hearing people talk, people's stories and so on. And so you hear what was, you see what is, it's not the same thing, right? And so to me, a good audio walk is actually not immersive. It's actually about friction, right? It's about past and present sort of rubbing up against each other, which raises political questions, right? And I think these two, the two walks that we organize, that we have online for these two neighborhoods, I think contribute to that.
Okay, definitely. I will mention it in our interview introduction. And let's talk about three keywords in this book, I think. So there are three interconnected processes repeatedly appearing in your book. The first one is urban revival, second one is urban deindustrialization, and the third one is gentrification. So based on the case from Montreal, What are the relationship between these three words? Could you provide us with some concrete examples from book to explain the connection and difference between these three different phenomena?
And I would add a fourth one to that list, suburbanization. And because suburbanization is happening a little bit earlier, and in Montreal, it's not so much about white flight, it's actually about middle class flight. And so you have out migration in the 1950s, and you can sort of understand why, because until like 1970, 40% of the homes in these two neighborhoods were cold flats, which means they didn't have running hot water. And so if you wanted to have like a hot bath, right, you had to go out, put it into cans and bring it back, or boil it yourself. There's all kinds of stories about, communal bath water, right? And who got to go in first was important, right? You can imagine. And so people, if they could, they would leave. And so what happened in the factories, these neighborhood factories that I was mentioning before, they unionize in the 1940s, right? They get, the union comes in, wages go up, standards of living goes up, people are able to purchase a car, and that gives people options. And so what you start seeing is, in a way, the neighborhood and the factory sort of diverging, right? And so these neighborhoods start being left behind by unionized prosperity, not just by deindustrialization, but their decline begins earlier, and then urban renewal is a reaction to that, and then deindustrialization is happening at the same time, which is sort of like the final nail in the coffin kind of thing, where really it's the poorest of the poor that are left in these two neighborhoods, where like over half are on social assistance, welfare. Where you have every social problem imaginable. And so you have like divestment. So the factories, start to close in the 70s. That leads to stores closing, that leads to churches closing, that leads to out migration. Half the people leave, so the population's going down. Schools are closing. And so social divestment follows economic divestment. And so gentrification comes in, starting in the 1990s, but really after 2000, the property values are so low, and it's a central location, right, in the city. And then you have the metro, like the subway going through. So it's attractive. But what makes it really attractive is the canal. So the canal is abandoned in 1970. It's like sewer essentially, and the government sort of has it. They're trying to figure out what we're going to do with this thing. Right? We don't need it anymore. We don't need the ships aren't going through anymore. What are we going to do with this thing, right? And it's actually sort of like politics, that decides. Like Quebec, you've got like an independence movement in the 70s where, Quebec wants to separate, many Quebecers want to separate from Canada. And so the federal government decides at this moment, 1977, okay, we got to respond to these people. We're going to plant a big Canadian flag in downtown Montreal by making this canal a park, right? With like biking trails and walking trails. And so this post-industrial, this greening of the canal actually flips the neighborhoods, makes the these neighborhoods much more attractive to middle class professionals, right? And that's a big big turning point. And then you're seeing reinvestment, but further displacement. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's like a sketch of what's going on.
I think it's a fascinating explanation, and it will be very helpful for students of urban studies and urban history, I think. It's fascinating. So, but before the urban, deindustrialization, before renewal, before gentrification, first of all, we will have an urban culture. We will have a culture. Mm. We will have a sense of space. So this is what your first section is about. This first section is titled Industrial Culture. So let's talk about it. So you mentioned in your chapter one, a culture of industrialism was instilled in childhood, long before young people went to work in neighborhood factories. And I'm very curious about how do this kind of culture and identity form in early years of childhood, particularly through storytelling, through narrative? Could you give us some examples?
It's my favorite chapter, actually, the industrial childhood chapter. Oral history is really strong on childhood memories. They're very vivid. It's a formative period for people. It's very local, how people remember. Our interviews were life story interviews, but we also did a lot of walking interviews where we're walking the streets and people are talking about, you know, what this was or the story that happened there. And so we have like hundreds and hundreds of these stories, and you start seeing patterns, right? Around, you know, a class identity doesn't start when you enter the factory gate, right? It actually is instilled, as you're saying, right in childhood, that people start understanding that they're, you know, working class, you know, at a neighborhood level, right? So you have, you know, stories of you know, coming of age. It's very gendered, obviously, too. That boy stories, you know, they're more mobile. You know, younger girls have you know, family responsibilities, and these families have this, you know, there's a web of connection to these neighborhood factories, right? So you got, you know, it's like extended families. It's like, it's not like, you know, nuclear family, one child. We're talking big families, right, with like extended, and so you have, you know, almost like a block of like family members kind of thing, and they're all like working at different factories. And so the divide between sort of work and home isn't what it is today. Like, it's not like this bifurcated thing that are, you know, two separate worlds, but it's actually, you know, woven together. And so deindustrialization is really tearing that apart, right? Now, it's different within the Black community because, you know, like Montreal doesn't have like, you know, formal segregation like a lot of the United States had, where you had colored only or white only signage, but you had a system of like de facto segregation, right? That were certainly prejudice and racism, and so a Black Montrealer would never know, you know, going into say a store or a tavern, hotel for the first time, they'd never know if they'd be served or not, because in Canada, you know, there's property rights, so the owners have the right to serve who they choose. So you know, went all the way up to like, there's a case in 1936, Fred Christie, you know, he went to like the Montreal Forum, which is like the shrine for hockey, you know, Canada hockey, right? Like, it's like a, you know, this is like a shrine, right? There's a tavern at the bottom, and he went to have a beer, and he was refused service, and so he fought back, and he went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada saying, this is wrong, this is racism. And the Supreme Court said, no, this is property rights. It's not about race. And so he lost, right? And this was until the 1960s, right? Like, you know, and so you had, so that reinforces Black institutions trying to create a safe space within, you know, a context of hate and racism. And because, you know, these factories are not hiring Black people, there's a disconnect, right? And you even see that in the neighborhood, right? So this multiracial neighborhood of Little Burgundy, white people, men on the block would be walking south towards the factories on the Lachine Canal. All the Black men would be walking east towards the two railway stations. So even the daily rhythm of these neighborhoods is racialized, right? Based on sort of racial capitalism and what's going on there.
Fascinating. I think I like narrative and stories because this shows us a very difficult, very complex entanglement of different forces in today's world. Because when we talk about, when we, you know, transfer a story to other people, we actually consciously or subconsciously replicate some existing power structure. Mm-hmm. So I have a question about the culture of industrialism. Basically, when we talk about a culture of industrialism, what do we really talk about? Like in Little Burgundy and in Paul St. Charles, what is the difference or common points of their culture of industrialism, and how do these factory stories shape their, you know, local residents' attachment to the neighborhood and also play a role in shaping this culture of industrialism?
Well, these are great questions. Raymond Williams is very influential in terms of deindustrialization studies. So he's, there's two concepts that are really foundational. Like one is structure of feeling, right? Like how you have this sedimentation of experience that creates values and expectations and horizons and sensibilities, right? And so that, you know, that's very foundational to our understanding of what, you know, what's the impact of deindustrialization. It's not just about a paycheck. It's about, you know, worldviews. It's about identity. It's about place. It's much deeper than just, obviously the economic loss is huge, right? But it has a cultural and social dimension to it. And so that concept, you know, is really what's sort of organizing that first section, right? And thinking about how, you know, a structure of feeling is accumulated over time in a place, right? And how race then, you know, how that differs to some extent. And the other key concept is moral economy. So E.P. Thompson, Georges Rodin, and I think, you know, moral economy is really around, again, expected behavior of employers and so on. And I think these two concepts are interlocking. And a lot of the British scholarship really, you know, really is foundational, you know, in terms of those things. But power, you know, power structure. So like, you know, our interviews were both in English and French, like the book's in English, but the interviews were in English and French. And it's really fascinating interviewing people in French because, you know, when they're talking about work, these are industrial workers, you know, you start seeing English words. when they talk about the boss, right, you know, suddenly it's an English word, or they start talking about like different departments of the factory, that would switch to English. And the reason for that is that before the 1970s, capital or employers were Anglo, right? Sort of Anglo capital. And so bosses tend to be English, you know, workers were more likely to be French. So there's lots of poor, you know, poor Irish and poor English speaking people. And so in a way that imprint of that former power structure is actually audible in the interviews, right? And so I talk about that too, right? And how, you know, or even like within the neighborhoods, like French and English are there's a shift in the balance of political power in the 1970s towards French in Quebec. But before that, you know, the center of gravity was more English, you know, in the factories, but also on the street, right? And so a lot of Francophones would learn street English, right? Because, you know, that was sort of reality, right? And now it's, entirely different.
For sure. I can imagine this kind of, you know, linguistic changes, linguistic transitions happening in Montreal, because, you know, what people speak and how people speak and, you know, people speak in which condition is tightly connected to the current politics and the current, you know, society. So basically, narrative is a very flexible and a very useful lens for us to see all these transitions. So let's talk about the second section of the book. It's titled Neighborhood Displacement, which means the waves of upheaval caused by deindustrialization, urban revival, and also gentrification. And we have talked a lot about the transitions and the changes happening during the 1960s. And here, I think 1967 is a special year in the history of Little Burgundy. So during the whole 1960s, a period of high modernism, several transformations happened here. And specifically, what happened in 1967 in Montreal, in Little Burgundy, and what changes did this transformation during, you know, the whole period of time bring about in Little Burgundy?
I came to this, you know, this part of the story with the expectation that Montreal would be like, you know, like other places, right? That you see, you know, high modernism displacing, you know, African Americans in a large scale in U.S. cities, right? That you see also poor people, other poor people. And I sort of expected that, because this is a neighborhood that gets demolished, right? And so it's targeted. And so I expected, okay, well, they're targeted because it's, because it's a multiracial neighborhood, even it's only 50% black, but it's targeted. My research challenged that theory. And I was surprised, right? Because it's happening in a context of, in Quebec, it's sort of the quiet revolution. So it's like, this idea that the Francophone white working class was oppressed by sort of Anglophones and they're identifying with sort of, Black Panthers and other, anti-imperial or anti-colonial movements. And so you have starting in seven, starting in the '60s, an effort to, lift up white working class Francophones. And so what I found was, clear evidence that from the government's point of view, this was a white Francophone neighborhood, and it was majority white Francophone, Little Burgundy. And so it's racism because there's the erasure of the Black presence, right? But in terms of why that neighborhood is targeted, is actually about sort of Quebec nationalism. Now, that said, there's a disproportionate impact on the Black community. Black community institutions are dispersed. The community is dispersed. A lot of Black businesses that were based in that neighborhood no longer had a place, because when they rebuilt that neighborhood, it's the highest concentration of public housing in Quebec. There's very little space for actually businesses, right? It's like a bit of suburbs in the downtown. And so those Black businesses, had to go elsewhere where they really struggled, right? And we interviewed some people who told us that story. And then afterwards, you got a high concentration of public housing, which, becomes a problem, right? This is a part of a wider story, and there's not a lot of places for young people to hang out. And so you start seeing, and you have an economic crisis, and you have a lot of job loss, a lot of, family breakup. And so this becomes like, headline news as sort of like Quebec's, racial ghetto. And this is a, whereas before you the neighborhood was not only culturally diverse, it was economically diverse, right? You had middle-class people also living in this neighborhood. And so that, clear-cutting of the neighborhood had a devastating impact, right? And eventually the neighborhood was able to organize and lift itself up, and it's now, a much better place. But that government intervention was devastating. So the book talks about that story.
Okay, so it's very related to the governmental intervention into the two neighborhoods. And also, let's talk about another very important topic in the section two about industrial heritage. So actually, in this book, I think you challenge a conventional understanding of industrial heritage, because normally we think industrial heritage will be very helpful for urban revival and will be helpful for empowerment of the local neighborhood. But actually, based on your oral history research, you basically provide some different perspective. So my question is, how does industrial heritage function in depoliticizing deindustrialization and gentrification, especially in Montreal? And also, how do they play a complex role in these processes?
Well, I think what I see in Montreal, I see in many countries, right, around industrial heritage. So there's this, heritage is about recognition, right? So it's recognizing the industrial past. But in the context of the Lachine Canal, like, it's Parks Canada, it's a park, it's supposed to be about industrial heritage, but the history it tells is a history of shorn of any division, any of working class people, essentially, right? So it's a history that is very compatible with gentrification, right? So that what you start seeing in the 1980s. Are former factories being converted into condominiums, right? And so this is, this is an interesting process itself. And we interviewed people who are moving into these former factories. of being drawn to sort of an industrial aesthetic. But of course, these buildings are not what they were, right? They're transformed, so very much post, post-industrial spaces that are very exclusive, right? That are very expensive, and so you start seeing this band of industry along the canal becoming a band of affluence, right? A very high-end condos, and then within that, you've got this industrial heritage recognition that is more just smoothing the change, right? It's a bit of like symbolic recognition, but at the same time as you're basically appropriating that history for for economically privileged people. And so I'm pretty tough on Parks Canada on this, and I do think it raises wider questions, right? Like who benefits from industrial heritage? Who's it for in the end? And so you can look at you can look at industrial heritage sites or adaptive reuse examples, right? Or culture-led gentrification, and start thinking about, and then you start seeing like developers like wrap themselves in the cloak of I'm in favor of industrial heritage while they basically convert it for exclusive use. And so you have one site left on the canal that's still a ruin, right? It's still like this abandoned building, and it's right now there's a big debate around it, like, and the community is saying we want this to be social housing. Like there's no social housing on the canal itself, right? That's only affluent space. We want this space to be for for ordinary people, and and they're saying with or without the building, right? The building, it'd be great to keep the building, but it's more important that we are able to remain in the neighborhoods that we have this multi-generational connection to. Whereas the developers are saying, well, I'll preserve this building, right? But preserving what exactly? And again, for who?
So I think this actually reflects that when we talk about industrial heritage, we need to situate it in the context of urban or urban politics of place. We need to, contextualize it in very specific political context to talk about its benefits or it or the difficulties it actually caused to urban revival, to empowerment. And this is exactly what the third section of the book talk about. It discusses how place-based identities have been mobilized to resist planned closing and gentrification. So in chapter 7, you show us the case of a local activist organization, and this organization hopes to mobilize local residents to resist planned closing. So why do they fail to achieve their goal? And what is the biggest problem with their narrative and other efforts?
Yeah, so that last section that you have that one chapter on Pointe-Saint-Charles, one on Little Burgundy, and thinking about like representational struggles, right, in the context of gentrification, and so in the context of Little Burgundy, what you have is the branding of the neighborhood as a Black neighborhood, right? As tying it to Oscar Peterson, tying it to Oliver Jones, these the jazz era, right? And that's not coincidental, right? In the 1980s, Montreal's pivoting, away from industry and towards being like an events, an event city. And the Montreal Jazz Festival, the largest jazz festival, I think in the world, although I think maybe New Orleans might have something to say about that. So in a way, Little Burgundy's branding as jazz, the jazz center, is important to the authenticity of Montreal's claim to be a jazz city, and so this the neighborhood now has like murals that has Oscar Peterson murals. It's got Oscar Peterson Park. It's got Oliver Jones Building. It's got this and that. Everything's jazz, and so it's now seen as a Black community, although it's still very much multiracial. But there's no bandwidth in that sort of heritage remembering for other kinds of stories, right? Whether it's about collective struggle, right? The fight against segregation, racism, whether it's the fight against factory closures, all these other histories, right, are absent, right? And so what you have is a very consensual comfortable narrative in Little Burgundy. And so I talk a bit about that and what that does. In Point St. Charles, it's sort of a different problem, right? And again, I it's easy for me to sort of critique, but so Point St. Charles is known in Quebec as an activist neighborhood. It's a neighborhood where, you know, the first community health center was created. It was the first legal community legal clinic was created. The first social economy, like first co-op housing development, was in this neighborhood. And so it's like a strong activist neighborhood, and it has a very, you know, has drawn people to move there, often middle class people who are activists, progressive people, who, you know, a lot of anarchists, for example, and. And so this narrative of activism, I talk about this one mural. It's 80 meters long, and it's an amazing mural. Like I walk by it all the time, and it basically is a celebration of, like, you know, a village utopia, right? And so in that 80 meters, there's struggle, but it's a triumphant narrative, right? As if they won all those battles, when in fact, you know, Point St. Charles today is, you know, is heavily gentrified. You know, many, many people are having to leave the neighborhood that they grew up in, that their parents grew up in, their grandparents grew up in, because they can no longer afford the rent, or perhaps they inherited their house, but they can't pay for the, you know, rising property, you know, property taxes. And so you even see, like, you know, so all the stores are, you know, are changing now, they're upscale, or even the schools, they, because this was a marginalized neighborhood 10 years ago, you know, school children would get like a hot lunch for a dollar a day, right? And so that, you know, that was a hugely important thing for all families. All, you know, everyone was eligible for it, but especially for poor families. And that's gone, right? Because now the stats have changed, you know? And so it's actually harder now to be poor in the neighborhood than it was before. And you are displaced, you no longer at the center of, you know, of daily life. And so that chapter's thinking about a different kind of silence, I guess, when you have like an activist narrative that is about, you know, that's supposed to be about, you know, all the good fights, but then it becomes sort of like, you know, there's an erasure of, like, you know, like the limits, perhaps, right? Like, you know, like the failure to, you know, to modify gentrification, but also the factory closures, right? Like there was very little response, political response, in this activist neighborhood for all those closures, right? And so anyway, so I sort of think about that a bit. Sorry, I went on there a little bit.
No, I think it's really meaningful answers, and it's really fascinating description of the current issue in, you know, urban activism, and also about all these organizations, activities in similar urban neighborhoods. So basically, I think when you highlight a story, when you highlight a narrative or a piece of history, some other things, some other very important things are consciously or unconsciously forgotten, actually, or erased. So basically, from the perspective of an oral historian, what do you think, in your opinion, should activists do to transform all these memories or even silences into resources?
Yeah, I think good research, you know, and good citizenship is about reflexivity, right? About being, you know, self-aware, about reflecting on you know, on your practice, right? And the limits, you know, maybe the mistakes, the failures. We can learn, you know, more from our failures than we can from our victories. And so that kind of honest reflection, I think, is vital for everything, right? For activism, for research. And sometimes I think there's not enough space in sort of movement context for that kind of critical reflection, because you're applying for grants, you're doing this, you're doing that, this, you're so busy, you can't step back necessarily and look. And oral history too, oral history is also about creating a space of reflection, where it's not even just the researcher who has questions, like the person you're interviewing also has questions. So So I think a good interview, it's like you're both chewing on this and thinking about, you're thinking aloud together and trying to grapple, like grapple with the full significance of this history. And I think that is what it's all about, right? That grappling with with history right up to the present. And I'm a historian, but I believe fundamentally that we need to think about the relationship between the past and the present. And and there's a danger if you study the past, and not up to the present, that you sort of other it, right? That you remove it from the present. And that can depoliticize, right? Like it's like Parks Canada. One of my critiques of Parks Canada is that they stop in like 1940, 40, 45, right? And so, their interpretation doesn't talk about all these waves of upheaval or their own implication in it. And so there's this, the safe distance, right, which then leads to sanitization. There's a clarity in distance, but there's also like a, security for a state to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. I think what you said is definitely based on this concrete and a very specific experience in Montreal, Canada, but also what you said is also have the value beyond the context of Montreal, because you just reminds us of the importance of creating intersubjective dialogue between the past and the present, between the activists and the local community, and between different people. And this is what is very important and valuable, especially for oral history. So it's very fascinating. And finally, I want to talk about the pictures and illustrations in your book. It's really hard not to notice so many fascinating visual materials in the book. We can see hundreds of photographs of the two neighborhoods, and we can also see the pictures of the volunteers, the researchers who conducted the community engaged projects. So, going beyond the book itself, as an oral historian, could you let us know why visual material is crucial to oral histories, especially in deindustrialization studies?
Well, oral history is one of the few, I think, fields of like qualitative research which actually believes in our default is archiving the interviews, right? Like I think some disciplines you tend not to name your interviewees, and the danger with that is that you hold a monopoly of interpretation, right? Only you only We can only ask you about that. We can't ask them, right? Because you don't know who they are. Whereas in oral history, it's archived, and so history has a face and a name and a voice, and so these photographs, the photographs, of course, are image worlds. They come with perspective. We have to think about where they come from. And so, for example, there's like in the chapter on urban renewal, we have these state photographs where, for every property that was expropriated, they have, a guy in a suit holding a number, often in front of people. Like they're going inside the houses and outside the houses. There's 1,000 of these photographs, just a little Burgundy of the streets they expropriate, and that tells us a lot about state power, right? And it also tells us a bit about social history. These places, they're also going into taverns and workplaces, or Canadian Button factory. There's probably a dozen or so photographs of all these people at work, and they're all white in this multiracial neighborhood, which taught me again, I think makes visible, the exclusion of Black Montrealers. So the photographs, so you have photographs that are from the state, you got photographs that are sort of from some photographs that are from corporations, that are presenting themselves to wider publics. But most of the photographs are actually community based, right? That they are generated by community organizations, or they're generated by interviewees themselves, family photographs and so on. And so I think they reinforce, they add another dimension to the stories that you're reading or listening to in the case of the audio walk. And so they reinforce, I think, this image world or this culture, this culture of industry or industrialism. And so I'm a big fan of photography helping to generate a context, right? I get a sense of place, what this place was like, but also how it's changed, right? So there's also a lot of, they're not just historic photographs, there's also photographs. I worked with David Lewis, who I've worked with in the past. I did another book called Corporate Wasteland, which was on sort of the representation of deindustrialization in Detroit and so on. So I worked with him again, and he was taking photographs of urban change, right? And I'm amazed at how like a still photograph can actually capture movement, right? Where you see, the urban landscape transforming before you, right? Whether it's condo advertisements, whether it's demolition, whether it's ruination. Anyway, so the photographs are a big part of the book, and the online version is great, but I think the paper, something about paper. I come from like a paper mill town, right? So I'm biased on paper, but I think there's something tangible when you're going through and the feel of it. I love books, right? I always have, and so if you do get a chance, I think you got the book, right? So
I got the book, and I need to tell our audience, if you have opportunity and if you have enough budget, you need to get a physical version. It's fantastic. The texture, and when you see all these pictures and you see it, parallel with all this text, it give you a just, I think, a different feeling. And definitely, I'm also a lover of physical books. I think, the electrical one is useful and is efficient and it's cheap, but the physical one is fantastic.
No, I totally agree. And the price, actually, we were able to keep the price down. So it's about $50, which is, expensive, but it's not. Sometimes you get these books now that are $150, which I think, it's ridiculous, right? There's no reason for that. But yeah, we really, that was another thing that we did, was we were able to fundraise and get money so that we kept the price down. So that way it's a bit more affordable, right, to people's budgets. Because you can have a great creative, a great participatory process, and you end up with a book for $150. It's sort of hypocritical, right? So I think the press did a beautiful job with that book. And yeah, it's a labor. I think every book's a labor of love. Every author,
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I publish, a number of books, and this is a particular, this is a particularly, it's particularly true in this case,
Yeah,
I'd
I think
say.
it's, I need to state, I need to note to our audience that this book is basically an integral part of your community engaged research, community engaged project. So don't miss this chance. It's a fantastic one, and the physical version is just good. It's so great. So yeah, love it. And as we are approaching to the end of the podcast, my last question is, what are you working on now, and what is your plan for your future projects?
Well, I have this big, so I so so my next sort of dimension of my work is thinking about transnational approaches by scaling up, right? And so we have this big project. You can go to the website deindustrialization.org, and it's sort of inspired by, the rise of right-wing populism. You think of Trump or Brexit or the rise of the Front National in France. And there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of assumptions around the connection between, deindustrialization and right-wing populism. Like, about the Rust Belt, in 2016 in the United States. And so what we're doing is we're doing a study of Western Europe and North America with connections to also to China and to Chile, and India, because it's a global story, to think about deindustrialization and its politics, right? And how, like, what's going on in these left-behind places. And of course, Pointe-Saint-Charles and Little Burgundy were left behind, but you did not see right-wing populism emerge in those spaces. And so it's interesting where it emerges and where it doesn't. Like Scotland, for example, it's been very progressive in areas that have been deindustrialized. And so we're interested in that, and we're looking at also like gender and environment and also heritage, because heritage has a politics too. And so this is a big project until 2027, and many books will come out of it. It's a big, you know, we got dozens and dozens of researchers and trade unions and heritage museums and so on in Germany and France, Italy, U.S., Canada. So yeah, that's the next stage. Then I retire, I think. So.
Oh, I think it's super interesting, and it sounds like a very timely project for today's world and today's, this moment, basically, for pop to understand populism and all these important issues. So I would love to know more about them and have another interview on them when you have another book, maybe before you're in, your retirement. I think it's fascinating. Your works are fascinating. So, Professor Heitz, thank you so much for coming to our podcast today.
Well, thank you so much, Elon. This has been a great conversation, really enjoyable. So,
Thank you. It's my pleasure. It's totally my pleasure. So in today's podcast, we discussed the new book by Stephen Hyde, Deindustrializing Montreal: Entangled Histories of Race, Residence, and Class, published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2022. This book not only offers us two in-depth case studies through making a cross-neighborhood comparative oral history, but also bridges the literature on deindustrialization and on gentrification. If you are interested in urban history, oral history, working class history, or you are more interested in Montreal in particular, this book would perfectly fit your need. Thank you for listening to the Urban Studies channel of New Books Network, and we will see you next time.